and when I tell the teachers, so I can tell you something different from the other. But it's, the theme of it is, actually, first day, it's going to be for the reason to speak. It's nice to have a chance to be one of the first speakers in this room, and I thought I was going to be the first transparent speaker, but it's not as good as this. So I wanted to, I also apologize to Robin Chaman and his previous work. I want to tell you about, about what's the proposal for something I've been assessing about the last year or so. So this metric I actually mentioned in the reference, SLED for short, and so the reference is to Citizen Kane, if you've seen the movie, there's a session that goes on about SLED in that movie. And so the reason we're obsessing is much less here that are collaborating on various aspects in this, the two groups, one of whom is thinking about the cosmological constant aspect of this, which is the motivation of it, some of which I will talk about the most today. And then some of us were thinking also about the picture we would have for just for part of the flag. It's a different way of realizing the symmetry of the weak scale, which has a different experimental signature than what you would normally expect. And that's very exciting, given that it's going to be tied to a proposal for understanding the cosmological constant problem. So should it all play out the way I hope it does, then there will be many ways to test this, including in collaborations. So it's a very nice connection between cosmology and the particle physics. The various things I'll tell you about are in these questions. This is the way I like to organize. Can I tell you anything? So I'm going to first give you a bit of a motivational speech, which reflects directly to Chaman's ending of his talk. Just what I'm trying to accomplish here. And it's going to be something which, if you had been around in the 80s as I was, you will all recognize. Black and Funny was motherhood and what everybody would have believed in. And it's only recently been true that the kind of things that I'm going to ask of an explanation of dark energy or cosmological constant, that people have been willing to give those things up. So I'd like to kind of remind you what those issues are and why issues like technical mindfulness are desirable, although logically not necessary. And in particular, I'm going to emphasize on the pitfalls that you hit. You know, what makes the cosmological constant part problem hard? Folks have done it at the beginning. And I'm going to focus on Weinberg Novo here because there's been a lot of discussion recently about it, in particular in the context of this proposal. And I want to say about what it is before I address how this particular model is in the open. This is about the cosmological constant, and you know it's a hard problem. We know that it's going to be a curriculum, and this is a work in progress. So not all these issues have been addressed, but I'll take you through some of these issues to show you that some of them are addressed, and it's, some of them are very promisingly going to be addressed, I think. And so even if this doesn't pan out from the end of the day, one of these eventually gets us. I think this has actually gone in an interesting direction, and the thing that gets us is going to be easier to think about than the cosmological constant problem. And the final part, which I probably won't have time for, I put down because I want to say misled before someone else does. The minimal version of this is the minimal special large intervention, so that's the kind of thing that has very many experimental implications beyond technology. And one of the most interesting things about this proposal is that it ties together the test of gravity, cosmology, and particle physics in a way which is kind of unusual. So. Let me dive right into what's the problem. So I'm going to focus on the naturalness issue in cosmological constant, and I'm going to do that because I think that is the theoretical tool that makes progress on this problem possible. It makes it difficult, but it makes it possible. And it does makes it both difficult and possible because it's the thing that makes the tension between what you can speculate about and what is a successful description of the data. The data in itself for dark energy is not so restricted. There are millions of models for dark energy out there, picking up millions of models. And it's not difficult to make a model which agrees with the cosmological data alone because there's not that much data. It's exciting the data that's there, but it's not so restrictive. So I want to distinguish the naturalness issue between the thing that embedding a successful phenomenology of cosmology into the microscopic physics is the opportunity we have now. And that in itself is a funny thing, which I'll get to in the next slide. So the issue is, of course, that we now see this dark energy, it may or may not be a cosmological constant. If it is a cosmological constant, then it would be, that's the simplest explanation, I guess, the currency. It would have a numerical value in fundamental units, which is something like 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the power. And the basic problem has always been, even when you thought it was zero, is why don't the known particles that we know a lot of, think we understand, contribute to larger contributions to the cosmological constant through their loop effects, the quantum effects. So typically, if you integrate a particle of mass m, it contributes to the amount of m to the fourth to the cosmological constant. And of course, all the m's for all the particles you know are bigger than 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. And that's the problem. So the electron in particular is huge, but you can take it up to the weak scale, and you're already 50 orders of magnitude too large. People often think that Planck scale, that's overkill a little bit, because we do understand why the cosmological constant could naturally be as small as the supersymmetric grading scale. In supersymmetric models, if you don't break supersymmetry, bosons and fermions cancel in a way you won't know if you're. If you break supersymmetry, then the failure to cancel vanishes with the supersymmetric grading mass. So the M supersymmetry here is the typical splitting between bosons and fermions. The generic model gives you a answer like this, which is quadratic in that mass, and then some other large scale, possibly Planck mass, occurs as well. But you can also make models for that term is not there in four dimensions, and you're led by that term, depends on how you detail the model. But the suppression by the supersymmetric scale is something which is easy to get, and so you need to take the Planck mass before you can estimate if you believe the supersymmetry kicks in at some scale that needs to get higher. That's one of the last things on the problem books. The problem there is that we know that the supersymmetry grading. Well, the mass between the electron and the particle difference is at least the weak scale, so that this won't take you below the weak scale. So it's not helping you with the real problem, which is why does the physics we think we understand the electron not do the interface contribution? If you believe that dark energy is actually not time independent, as it would be if it were a cosmological constant. So if you plot the energy density inverse against the scale factor, a log of radiation matter of the polynomial parameters. The cosmological constant would have just been that constant, but if varying in time, as long as it's kind of matter dominated or it's potential energy dominated now, or has the right equation state now, it could be the dark energy. There's additional problems in this kind of a formulation in addition to this problem. That is, particularly if you're thinking of this as being it's the most precise phrasing of this second nationalist issue. In this case, comes if you think of this as being a scalar field. The scalar field that's rolling around now, as this would be doing, because it's time independent, but has to have a mass which is smaller than the present day Hubble scale. And that in the same units is 10 minus 33 electron volts. And so there's an enormously light scalar in any of the models that do this. Very generically, it's gravitationally coupled, and there's a hierarchy problem like the usual electromagnetic hierarchy problem. In that case, how do you keep scalars that light? Let's embed them into any microscopic theory which has higher scales, as we know the real physics of the world does, because it's scattered models. There's another issue with observationally. Even if you're successful in understanding the nationalist issue, why don't you see deviations of gravity? Because that's a long range force, and it's gravity plus gravitation coupled. The model line I described to you addresses, I think, both of these, but it certainly addresses this issue in the sense that it ties this one to this one. And if you understand why. The things that I'll have to argue for you are small, understand why the cosmological constant and the dark energy is small in value, will automatically guarantee it's going to be a model of the type where things are changing in time, but it's going to automatically explain the smallness of this mass in terms of the smallness of the dark energy to get there. So I wanted you to know that there's this issue involved. So what's the hard part? Why is it true that it's difficult to make models which do this? There's two parts to difficulty. The traditional part is the quantum correction part. And so there's an issue there, which you could ask, why do you care the size of quantum corrections if you don't measure it separately, classical contributions and quantum contributions? So the way to think about this nationalist issue is, I think, in terms of the way you understand the normalization now. It's that we understand that really classical quantum split is probably not the way to think about things. It's better to think of things as scales. If we're looking at when Einstein wrote down his classical Lagrangian, what he was really doing was writing down the effective theories on scale. And the quantum part, the calculations you do with that Lagrangian are really integrating out the physics at that scale and going the longer wavelength to get another effective theory. So the classical quantum split is really comparing two quantum theories with different scales in that language. And so in that kind of picture, you can ask, if I have a small thing, like the cosmological constant or anything else, like the size of the nucleus compared to an atom, there's many hierarchies of scale in nature. And the reason physics progresses is that you can understand them one at a time. And so that it's possible to decouple the short physics from a long physics. It's one of the few principles that you can really get the farm on in physics, because that's why we're here now. We understand as much as we do. We didn't have to understand all of string theory to get pattern from. And so, all of those cases, except for the cosmological constant and possibly the hierarchy problem, yet the way that those smallness of a hierarchy is understood, a ratio of scales is understood, is in two steps. In the fundamental theory, in this short distance theory that God gives you, there's a parameter that describes what you're interested in, or some combination of parameters which describe what you're interested in, and that's small in the microscopic theory. But you don't measure this small energy scale in the short distance theory. You measure it at long distances, and so the appropriate thing to do with that microscopic description is to integrate out the physics between the short distance scale and the scale where you do the measurement of that quantity. And the second thing that happens in all other hierarchies is that integration process keeps the small parameters small. So that, for example, if we think that string theory is right, the way you have to explain it, a better example would be if the hierarchy we're talking about is, say, why a nucleus is small compared to an atom, we understand in the atomic theory, QED, that's true because the electron mass is small compared to the proton mass, and also the fine structure constant is small. Now, if we ask that same question in the physics inside a proton, QCD and other things, it's also small there, and we can understand it at that scale as well, because the QCD scale is larger than the electron mass. And it's also true that if we start off with the standard model inside a proton and integrate out the physics to longer scales, the running of the masses doesn't ruin our understanding of the smallness of the electron mass compared to the proton mass or the QCD scale. And so it's possible to understand the hierarchies everywhere else in physics, both microscopically and macroscopically, at any scale you choose to understand. Now, the cosmological constant, the way we understand it now, and anthropic reasoning is right, the only way we'll understand it, is that what happens is that in God's theory, there are enormous values for the cosmological constant in the theory or in the vacuum string theory you're interested in. And as you do the integrating out from small distance physics to larger distance physics where you're trying to do cosmology, the cancellation of that integration process gives you another large contribution, which exactly cancels the contribution you started off with, to give you a small number that you measure. Now, that never has happened before, and so I think the conservative point of view is that it won't happen again, and that a proper understanding will understand both these things together. And that's been an obstacle for progress, largely because there are essentially no examples which do this because of the process. So what's exciting about the proposal I'm going to make is that if it succeeds, it will be the first example. It's not clear that it succeeds yet, but it's, I think, along the road farther than most proposals have thought at this point. What's also exciting is that part two is the hard part of the problem, the electron and string theory, integrating on physics. QED is wrong, and the reason it's wrong is that it gives you the wrong answer for its contribution to cosmological constants. So whatever it is that you do to solve this problem, it's not something which you can hide at the Planck scale. It's something which is going to be in your face at the electron scale, so there's going to be other observational consequences to it besides cosmological constants. So if this is right, it would be right in space. There would be many ways to test it, and so that would be in particular true with the proposal of QED together. So it's certainly desirable to do. It's just been difficult, and I think that a lot of the anthropic thinking these days is driven by the absence of examples in this particular case. And it's despair at some level. And how do you make progress when there's no examples of these ones? One thing that an anthropic proponent would have to explain, though, is why the vacuum we're in happens to explain that one thing anthropically and not all the other hierarchies in the world. All right, the second thing that makes this kind of problem difficult is not really, it's partly classical, partly quantum problem. It's called Weinberg's no-go theorem. And essentially what it does is it's not really a generic issue for cosmological constant problem, but it is in practice an issue for most of the proposals that have been made over the last 20 years. And essentially, those proposals fall into a category where the problem with the cosmological constant is that once you solve the equations of motion, you've made the derivative potential zero where the vacuum is, but the value potential doesn't have to be zero, and generally isn't zero, and requiring it to be zero determines your problem because you don't have a new field with it. So the various proposals that Weinberg criticizes, and the one I'm going to give you in this category, has a field of phi, and it has the property that its equation of motion is proportional to the vacuum energy for all of the fields. And a very easy way to do this, because they all make F stuff, is essentially this field couples to everybody else, multiplying the metric. And so you can kind of imagine that when you vary the equation when it goes to 5, as far as its coupling to other matter are concerned, you're doing the variation of the metric, and so you're getting the trace of the stress tensor, and that's the one crossing. And so if box 5, for instance, was this, then for static configuration vacuum, the equation of motion 5 is supposed to be driving the effective cosmological constant to 0 to get the field. So the hope is that there's a mechanism here where the theory adjusts itself and makes this case flow.
Thanks, Greg. This is sort of a general question.
Yeah.
In any theory that successfully explains this way, why the cosmological constant is 0 or small, do you have inflation?
Well, it depends.
Also stop inflation.
That depends on, so that's the kind of too much of a good thing problem.
Yeah.
And so it depends on exactly what the mechanism is. So what, I'm going to give you an example, which I think doesn't have the problem with inflation, but we're doing this now. But whether you believe it or not, you see it again. So to make that as serious, what's really going on is that's a scale invariance. It's a scale invariance of this problem. And the logic of what makes these models work is this. Imagine if you have a bunch of scalar fields and they all transform like scalar fields do under scale transformations, then it's always possible to write down a potential energy, and it's always quarter, essentially, if you find that scale invariance. And that's true classically. And if you imagine there's some miracle that made there be no anomaly in scale invariance, that would also be true with quantum levels. So let's just put aside the quantum issue for now and just ask, supposing we did have scale invariance, does that solve the problem? Now, it looks like it might for this kind of argument. And it superficially does. Typically, what you'd want to do is you have a potential, but you don't want to have a potential to have a unique minimum of 5 equals 0. So 5 equals 0 is a minimum. But if that was the unique minimum, that's also the point which does not break scale invariance, so there are no masses in that problem and there's no scales. And the problem with the cosmological constant is that you've got a non-zero or a very small cosmological constant, but you have other masses which are large to compare it to. So this is an interesting proposal, only as much as you spontaneously break scale invariance. So you imagine there's a zero eigenvector to this matrix, and you're such that it's a flat direction in the field space. And then at any one point here, it looked like a quartic field of potential in other directions. And at this particular point where all the fields are zero, you knew that the answer was zero because that was scale invariance telling it to you. Now you also know that the answer for the potential energy is zero along this whole trough because of scale invariance. Any point on this trough can be related to that point by a scale transformation in a particular field, one that was not contributing to the potential. And so you're guaranteed that those are generic solutions. And so that because the scale invariance point was at zero, they all have to be zero. That's the physics behind this mechanism. You're saying spontaneously broken scale invariance could save the day because you can live out here somewhere, have this field couple some fermion or something, and give them mass, and yet you knew that the vacuum energy was going to be zero. Now, the problem with this, Weinberg points out, is that scale invariance in itself can do those things, but you can't forbid quantum correctness from changing things, and the zeroness of this eigenvalue is not protected by scale invariance. So when you quantum correct this kind of a theory, even assuming that the quantum corrections preserve scale invariance, what do? They typically will lift that flat fraction. Because it's flat, arbitrarily small things can compete with it. And so you can imagine quantum fractions at some point, lifting the degeneracy. And scale invariance won't stop you getting a 5 to the 4th potential in that direction. And then you not solve the problem because you're back in a situation where it is true that the minimum is at zero energy, but it's not true that you play against non-zero masses. That's what Weinberg's theorem says is the difficulty. So the problem will be, if somebody produces a potential like this, and I'm going to give you one which is flat like this, what is it that protects you from getting this kind of a shape to your potential? And the proposal I'm going to give you, there will be a shape. This will happen. There will be a flat direction which gets lifted. But that will be the dark energy. The reason it's not constant is that we're rolling now on that. So it's a very shallow direction. And the reason it's shallow will be because supersymmetry keeps it shallow. And so the point of this mechanism will be that there's a way of decoupling a supersymmetry breaking scale to this scalar, these scalars, from the supersymmetry breaking scale we infer from the absence of supersymmetry right now. And Weinberg, of course, doesn't say that that's, you can't make potentials flat for supersymmetry to do that. But implicitly, the problem in the supersymmetric model is why should the flatness set by this potential of the mass scalarity so different from the supersymmetric masses? And that's the progress of the supersymmetric makes. So what is the proposal? So we're looking for an idea that the essence of the nationalist problem is that you're saying that the most general thing at low energies that you can get in vector theory has property A, property A is wrong, like the cosmological constant law, which is the property A in this case. And typically what's wrong when those things are solved is you say the most general thing is whatever it is. most general and implicit assumptions in it, which we didn't articulate. And if you don't identify those assumptions, then you can make progress by seeing how you can change them. So the assumption in this case that I'm going to give up is that the world is four-dimensional, because the estimates that the cosmological constant is getting corrected by order of mass of fourth was a four-dimensional argument. And that's logically possible, as we know, since these authors are kind of out of the body and the conscious. Pointed out that in a brain world picture, you can have a six-dimensional world where we're trapped on three and four-dimensional surfaces, and the extra dimensions could be as large as is allowed by gravitational tests. Gravitational tests are all that count because all the other targets we live on are trapped under the brackets by assumptions. Only gravity is seeing these extra dimensions. And it happens that the observational limit for tests in the block kick in about 100 microns. So the observation is that these extra dimensions could be as large as 100 microns, and that would be an acceptable way to live, as long as you're in six dimensions. That's important for the neurology domain. Hierarchy problem, understanding the size of the leaf parameters versus the quantum gravitational effect in this picture. Now, what's nice about that is that that scale, as many people have observed, 1 over r, the energy units in this case, is about 10 to the minus 3 by r. That is the energy scale of the cosmological constant. So, the appeal from my point of view is that we're looking to give up the assumption of four dimensionality, and here's the extreme case where you can give it up, and it happens to take in exactly the right numerology for the cosmological constants. But triple B, can you make a model like this for which you can take advantage of the fact that the cosmological constant, you can make a cosmological constant care about this radius and not care about the intrinsic part of the physics scales on the brain? So that's what I'm trying to do. Now, another clue I'm going to take is that I'm looking for flat potential, so I want supersymmetry, and that's also possible if you guys are getting this in the string theory, let's say. So if this is a supersymmetric world, which is what these people did not do because they're trying to have an alternative to supersymmetry, then what has to happen is, I should have said up here, that to get the Planck mass right down here, the numerology that's interesting here is that the radius in response to the cosmological constant is also the radius corresponding to the upper limits on the strength of tests of gravity inverse square law of gravity. But it's also the radius that corresponds to choosing the gravity scale of the extra dimensions as low as it possibly be, which is the Lewis scale. So if you ask how the four-dimensional Planck mass is related to the radius and the six-dimensional Planck mass, if you like, they're related this way. And so that's the Lewis scale if you've chosen this to be 100 microns. So given that statement, if we did this in a supersymmetric way, what would we expect to see? You'd expect to be living on a branch. The scale of the extra dimensions we now know is something like the Lee scale, TEB scale. And we know that, so whatever is going on, supersymmetry has to be badly broken on our brains. It has to be true that the things that are trapped on a brain are not, the supersymmetry transformation of them is giving us a zero moment density on the brain, like we'll see now, rather than giving us a super part term, which has a mass which is probably better. That's not difficult to do in explicit brain models. Very supersymmetry at the TEB scale. But what's interesting is that in the extra dimension is the supersymmetry scale for the graviton is much smaller. And there's two ways to think about why it's much smaller. In any supersymmetric theory, the supersymmetry scale of the multiplet is given by the basic supersymmetry scale of the depth of approach symmetry times the coupling of your multiplet to that field of approach symmetry. So in this case, fields on the brain are breaking supersymmetry by the gravitational scale of g. And things in the bulk are all tied to the graviton by supersymmetry, so they're coupling with gravitational strength. So their splitting is going to typically be about the order of mg times the coupling strength, which is mg over m prime. So you're led to a mass splitting the gravity moment, which is of this sort. And that's also about the order of 1 over r, given this numerology that relates mg to m prime. Another way of thinking about that is that in the Kluge-Klein level, the graviton has a zero moment because we know we have a mass of 4-dimensional graviton. But the boundary conditions that appear at the distance of the brain, because they set up conical singularities, for instance, destroy the killing spin that makes things supersymmetric. And so what we find is that the graviton typically has no zero moment, so the splitting of the gravity moment is explicitly the Kluge-Klein mass. In this case, that's 1 over r. And by using 1 over r here and using this formula, I'm assuming the extra dimensions are not warped. That would be one of the pitfalls that we're going down the road. Warping is dangerous in this business because if you think of the random summary model, the generic thing that happens is that this connection between the gravity scale, the Planck scale, and the radius changes. And so the radius density, if you adjust the radius to make the gravitational strength be what you want it to be, they put the pine mast to come up in the Randall's Island picture. So you know that, for instance, in the ADD picture, there's lots and lots of Kluge pine states that start on very low masses like this. But in the Randall's Island picture, you can have the first Kluge pine mast a few weeks ago because the hierarchy is being dealt with by the board building management. And so large Kluge pine masts are going to be a problem for you because I want to live off the fact that here, this looks like you're breaking scale in the bulk. Is the scale that I want? So if we didn't have the drains, the bulk is a supersymmetric theory which is broken at the scale of the cosmological constant. So it's not going to be so hard to imagine that the quantum corrections in this case will be the right size. The trick will now be to understand why the particles we know about that are living on these drains aren't screwing up by giving them a much bigger one. And that's the thing I'm going to describe now. So we're arranged to be in six dimensions above the cosmological constant scale. So, and we're interested in what happens when you integrate out physics from the weak scale into the cosmological constant. That has to be done at six dimensions in this picture because it's that's the regime in which there's six dimensions. So here's a cartoon of how the arguments kind of work. And I'll give you a better argument. A supergravity, or this Faraday supergravity, is in the six dimensions, and the boson parts typically look like this. There's an Einstein, there's an Elton, there's some freeform, so the two index, the potential, and this often maxwell fields. And there's sometimes a potential energy of the boson, depending on whether or not the theory is like this H supergravity. So this G is a parameter which may be zero or something. You get both signs here, depending on this. There's a Roman supergravity to give you the sign which corresponds to a negative potential here, and it's a non-chiral theory. And then Chikin-Sesskind version gives you a de Sitter-like sign here, and it's the chiral supergravity. You know, but you also have engaged supergravity. Now, so what I want to do is describe what the cosmological constant problem looks like in this context. So the first thing we'll do is we'll integrate out the physics on the brains, because that's the stuff we'd like to really understand, and why is that complex? So imagine that it's exactly, so we're going to get a really big vacuum energy from them because they're not supersymmetric in any sense. But this is not a vacuum energy in the sense of a cosmological constant, this is a localized energy distribution at the position of the brain in the six-dimensional context. So we're going to get a tension, essentially, plus curvature correction and things, which I'll work later on. But the biggest thing will be a tension on the brains. And the size of the tension is again going to be the TV scale to the fourth because there's no cancellations going on there at all. Now, but we're not done yet. So what we're supposed to do is integrate out all the extra-dimensional physics to scales large compared to the Planck scale, because we're going to do cosmology in four dimensions at scales longer than 100 microns. And so we have to integrate out the bulk physics as well. And so that process I'm going to do in two steps. First the classical part of it, and then the quantum part of it. And so the argument I'm going to make here is that the classical part of integrating out the bulk is going to precisely cancel the contribution of the physics in the brain, and that all that will survive that cancellation will be the quantum contributions from the bulk, which I've argued already is a supersymmetric theory, which is supersymmetric scale is as small as we like. That's where we're going to go. So this is a cartoon of how that works, but it's going to need a better... part of the rest of the story is how to do better than this cartoon, but this kind of gives you a flavor of what's going on. So, what's the classical part of that argument? The classical part of integrating out the bulk essentially means solve the classical equations of motion in the bulk, including brains as sources. Now, in four-dimension two, as you have in this case, you can solve that problem because it's like a cosmic string. Cosmic strings don't give you chiral effects on this side of the cosmic string. They give you conical defects at positions of the string. And so the way you see things bending around a string is that there's a conical defect. So the light that leaves, you imagine you've removed the wedge, let's say, where the string is. And the light that leaves that wedge is identified over here, the light that's going on that direction. So the light is bending around the string even though there's no chiral effects because space is flat. It's a similar statement here, that if I have a geometry, it won't be necessarily flat because I'll have extra dimensions that could be for right or they could be square or something else. But there's going to be an additional contribution to the geometry coming from the fact that the position of these brains is going to be a conical singularity. And so that conical singularity shows up in the curvature of the metric involved as a delta function contribution, if you like. The normalization is set by Einstein's equation in terms of the tensions that were the sources. So these are localized positions of the brains. The normalization will let in the tension on that position.
So is there some of the angles in the quantum direction? It's like for a series you need to throw the depths to add up.
Yeah, there's a couple other conditions.
So that one plus some conditions in the quantum direction, so they on the brain they select the solution.
Yeah, I'm going to actually have a slide with that. At the class level, there is the best thing to do is to say, if you build a solution and you want to stick it together in a combat space, you're going to have to be careful about ranging the type of something in the angle that I'm doing. And then historically, the reason I can talk about it is that that's, we can do this for Torah, for flat spaces. It looks like you're finding things out on the constant in that way because it looks like you're choosing these tensions and just as a way to get through it. And I'm going to address why that's not a problem.
But in general, you're going to balance tension. I mean, in some way, you're going to balance tension and the solution part of the problem.
Right. Right. So the next thing to say here is that was the kind of scenario, but there's also some parts that we can spear through something else. And there's also other fields. So there's, it's not just the Einstein's action. There's the metric, there's the dilemma and other things. So if I ask at this class level what the effect of four-dimensional cosmological constant is, it has these parts. It has contribution directly from the tensions of the brains. And then it has a piece which is actually a classical action in bulk, averaged over the volume in bulk, evaluated as a classical solution. And that's zero for all these theories on a very general principle. The reason it's zero in detail is that the delta function part of this thing, this piece, is the constants here are just such that they completely cancel out this piece. So the tension drops out in general because of this contribution curve. And then the smooth parts, if we had not done a supersymmetric theory, you would have had a smooth part left, which is the thing you can do. But the smooth parts also cancel in this supersymmetric case, because the contribution of the dilaton and other things are canceling the smooth parts of the geometry. And that's true for any, you don't have to actually say anything. It's here. It belongs to zero. It's a general property that goes away with motion, which is flooding and social in the tank. Alright. So that's a cartoon, but there's a better argument. The other nice thing with six dimensions is that it's simple enough to explicitly define a lot of solutions. So there's a very broad class of solutions which are known, and I want to now take you through those solutions to show you the extent to which they support this argument, and what they also say about issues like Weinberg's theorem and Planck. You can imagine changing the tensions to your Luhmann's cancellation. Okay, so the simplest solution was known in the 80s. It's the, it's actually was found by doing the flying group, taking the chiral supergravity test of the Sitter Simon for the dilaton potential. Taking a flying group and have pansats for the gauge fields that live in the bulk, for one of them, U1. And then taking maximal symmetry in four dimensions, and then maximal symmetry in the two dimensions, so taking the sphere. And then asking what the solutions are subject to that symmetry. And what you find is that there's a solution that you can find a solution with a sphere. And the dilaton, they just stabilize in a nice way. But the surprise when it was done was that typically when you do this kind of ansatz in an occlusive fine theory, you can have the freedom of having any Sitter space or Sitter space here. And what they found was that when you do this ansatz, you always got flat space. And the reason that happened, you can kind of see from the action. Take the action, here's the Einstein term, the Maxwell term, and then the potential term. If you plug in this ansatz, then what happens is that this ansatz says that the magnetic field is sensing the magnetic field of a monopole, which you would have had a sphere if you hadn't had a monopole in the center. So if you think about the hub pen and the radius of the sphere, it goes in one of our R squared. The curvature itself goes in one of our R squared. And so if you plug in one of our R squared in here, you get something like this. Now what happens is that for this theory, there's a coefficient. I didn't tell you when I said it's a monopole, I didn't tell you what the monopole number was. If the monopole number was 1 or minus 1, it happens that the numerical coefficients in these two terms group into a perfect square. So you get something like this, which depends on the factor of the power of R and the dilaton. And this piece inside, which is squared. So the solution is always found when this particular piece is equal to 1. So you're stabilizing to get the dilaton in terms of radius. But there's a flat direction at that minimum, which corresponds to a combination of the radius and the dilaton, which is free to change. You're always going to have that flat fraction because there's a classic still in there, so once this was found, the surprise was that it was at zero. The belief was that that was an artifact of taking monopole number 1 minus 1 here, that if you had monopole number 15, then you would have expected a 15 squared here. So then the feeling was that you could put a square here and you find some solution which would be the Sitter space in the four-dimensional part or any Sitter space. But no one actually looked for those solutions until 2 years ago. And it turns out that when you do, those solutions are also fine. At this point, when people realized that this particular cancellation of the wave is done here relied on monopole number 1 or minus 1, it was also recognized that that is a choice for which the four-dimensional theory preserves one of the supersymmetries from six-dimensional theory. And that was part of why people stopped thinking about it, is that they thought they understood why the top one was not some zero risk case, which was because it was supersymmetric, and it happened to be one of these no-scale-like models, which is actually interesting. You can find the supersymmetry. There was an error in the papers at the time as to what spectrum must be. It's a minor error. If you start to find the vectors of gravity and formats, it's called rolling theory, and it's easy to understand. And it's flat in a way, which is interesting. Now, more recently, what's happened is that humans, Gibbons, and Pope tried to find the more general solutions, and they, in particular, found the more general solution subject to the assumptions, again, of maximum symmetry in the four dimensions. But all they assumed about the extra dimensions, they didn't several things in the paper, but the part I'm going to focus on is in their appendix, and they assume that they have axial symmetry in the extra dimensions. So there's one kilo vector, but it's not a, not two, it's not a sphere. There can be singularities in the metric. And there can be two, but it's actually symmetric. It could be one, could be two, or could be none. What they show is that the only solution that has no singularities is the one I just showed you, So they find explicitly all the other solutions in this class. And so in particular, they find the solutions for particle numbers 5 and 16 and other things that were not in the category that Hassan and Seskin looked at. And every single one of these has an intrinsic geometry in four dimensions as well. There's no serious solution for the one. None of them is supersymmetric except for the one I just showed you in the previous slide. They're all, for every other solution, the pulling vectors are there. Now, what's going on there is essentially a kind of scale invariance. It's like the one thing that Weinberg scale is addressed to, because the classical bulk theory is about scale invariance. So, if you have scale invariance, the equation modes of the dilaton is essentially ensuring that the action when evaluating the classical solution is zero. So it's exactly the kind of thing you learned in Weinberg's theorem before. And so the question would be, in fact, should you believe Weinberg's theorem? Is this going to be a function for which quantum fractions are going to be a problem? Because the scale invariance that you're relying on is not the same. On the special shape of words. So before I do that, I'll come back to Weinberg's theorem. Now, there's various issues about tuning that you need to worry about. So, for example, the solution that I gave you with the generic solution that Gibbons and Pope have singularities, and many of the solutions are quantum singularities. And so, you would think of those being having brains in them, and the singularities come with back after the brains through the presence of the brains. The simplest ones along those lines are spheres where you remove a wedge, and so the tensions are the defect angles, and at both ends of the wedge. You identify it. You take a wedge out of the line of constant longitude and you identify the end, which is the size of the wedge, and that gives you a constant defect at both ends. And the way you draw that, you can kind of see that the defect here is the same as the defect there. So that's an example of a solution, and you can kind of see from that description of it that the existence of this solution relies on an adjustment of one tension against the other tension. So you might worry, supposing this was a picture of the world, supposing it's true that the cosmological constant is zero the way I'm telling you it is because of the dimensions of gravity. What would happen if we're riding at this frame and the phase transition that changes the tension? There's no way by causality that something changes at the same time. So there's an issue. We start perturbing the tension on one side. Where does this go? And does it develop as cosmological constant? Now, the total time-dependent problem that you need to solve that is in progress, but it hasn't been done. But there's some things you can say about it given the generality of the Friedman's theorems and Pope's solutions. And that's what I want to talk about now. There's two kinds of constraints in this kind of problem to think about. It turns out that there's the constraint in this particular case that these defect angles are equal to one another. And there are also two other constraints. Those two other constraints are topological, the ones you alluded to. There's one that says that all of these solutions they found have an Euler number appropriate for sphere, Euler number two. And there's also, because they have magnetic flux, there's a Pontryagin index or something which counts the such a monocle number, and that's the constraint. So the parameters of these solutions, these particular solutions satisfy three constraints, two topological ones and one non-topological. Now, the topological ones, I'm making that distinction because I'm going to argue that the topological ones are not a problem from this point of view, because if I have a solution which satisfies them, and I do a continuous deformation, I'm going to get a new solution which still satisfies the topological constraints, because continuous things are not going to be a problem for something which will change the validity of a topological constraint. So it changes its expression in terms of things like the radius, because the solution will have a different detailed form. But the constraint itself will not change the topological. The dangerous one to think about here is this explicit non-topological lines and tensions have to be equal to one another. So, what can you say about what happened in this case? Now, before I tell you what you can say from the Gibbons, Gibbons, Pope solutions, one thing you cannot do is do what people did in the 80s and ask answers by just in torment, which is what these people did. If these people make the same argument I just made in this last slide as to what perfect square of dimensions is, for module number one, it's perfect square, and that's why you have a flat solution in four dimensions. But that argument in the 80s also seemed to say that if you had module number not one, that you would have had non-flat solution, you'd have a zero phase solution in four dimensions. And that turned out not to be true for Gibbons and Pope. So what was wrong with that analysis? What's wrong with that analysis is that a four-dimensional analysis of the dynamics of the system assumes implicitly that the modes that you're following, in this case separately the dilaton and the radion, have masses which are systematically small compared to the Dilaton-Klein masses. That's the condition for being able to integrate out the Dilaton-Klein physics when you're described with dynamics in an effective four-dimensional world. Now, if I went back to the potential that I showed you in the previous slide for the radius and the dilaton, there was one combination of those things which is massive. And if you ask how big is that mass compared to the Dilaton-Klein scale, the answer is it's exactly the same. There's no higher view there at all. If you start following the radius of the dilaton with this fixed, that's a four-dimensional problem, because that was the flat direction of the potential. But if you separately vary the dilaton and the radius and allow them to explore that potential, then at the same energy cost that you're exploring, there are Dilaton-Klein modes that you're not exploring. And if you want to follow the dynamics, you have to follow those Dilaton-Klein modes as well. And that makes it intrinsically a six-dimensional problem. So it's not so simple as beginning to analyze the four dimensions. You have to really look at the six-dimensional solutions. But the good news is that a very broad class on its own, and so you can infer some things about the solutions, although not everything, because they assume the maximal symmetry in four dimensions, and so they don't capture the time-dependent evolution immediately at the transients that we change the dimensions. So there's kind of two things you can imagine. What can you say about these solutions from the four things off in the long run? What I want to argue for you is that I was actually worried about this problem, but I'm less worried now, because if you look at these solutions in detail, you'll give them to the Pope ones. You can ask the general class of axis symmetric solutions, is it true that this kind of constraint is holds? And the answer is no. The generic solution in the Gibbons, Gubbins, Pope class, there are only two constraints, and it's the two topological constraints. The generic solution has no additional constraints. So you might ask, what's the content of this constraint? It happens that if you ask the singularities of these solutions to be exactly conical and nothing else, so if you ask that the metric will be R squared, theta squared with some constant in front of the R squared and not R to some other constant, then you get a subclass of solutions. So there's essentially a three-parameter class of these solutions corresponding to the magnetic charge of the monopole and the two tensions in the brain of these children. And in that three-parameter family, there's a two-parameter subset for which the two defects are conical singularities only. And so that subset satisfies a constraint, which is this constraint. This is what defines the subset of the tension and tension of the plane, or T plus and T minus and tension for these two similarities. If you take this in a special case, it doesn't look like it, but it's true. If you take this in a special case that the tensions are equal to one another, it boils down to the same tension. Saying that again, then, if you take this in a special case, these tensions can be different. And if you have conical similarities, if you knew the tension here, you would know the tension here, because of the fact that all the solutions of this class have a constraint for those. And if I took the case where this was maximal symmetric, so it was just like a sphere, then I would have this was reduced. And well, it's not straightforward to see that. So, given that the generic solution does not have anything non-topological in the constraints, what you can hope is that if I started off near a solution that I understand and I perturb things, you can ask, is there a solution in the GGP class for that new pair of tensions? So if there's a solution in this category of solutions for any pair of tensions, then if you set the system off, there's kind of two things that can happen. You can have a runaway solution that will not ever return to the GGP solutions, or it could return to whatever the unique GGP solution is for that particular new pair of tensions that you have. So there's two tests you can make for that proposal. One of them is, if I sit, I know how to calculate the defect angles as a function of the tensions in the brains. If you give me the solutions and you give me the defect angles, or you give me the parameters of the solution that parameterize the GGP solution, I can calculate the tensions that are responsible. And that's kind of how I get this constraint from it. So I can cognitive tensions are as functional parameters. I'd like to know, is there a solution for any pair of tensions? The question is that an invertible expression that I got? My expression for tensions is functional parameters. And you can check that by just checking Jacobian, the position that the solution is to know, and the Jacobian is non-zero, so it's an invertible relationship. And so, at least interpretively close to the solution that you understand, and there are other solutions, there's a unique solution in this category, which has the tensions that you interpret to. And so now there's an issue as to whether or not, if you interpret things, do you go back to this new solution in this axisymmetric and axisymmetric category, or do you go off in some new direction? The way to decide that is a time-dependent stability analysis, which is we had thought we were through and found it was stable, but there's a bug on the program, so I'm not sure if we're in the process of doing that. But there's one thing you can learn already, in that one way to think about this is we're asking now, if you determine the tension, do you go back to the new GTP solution for those new tensions, or do you go off to something right away? Maybe the whole space shrinks, let's say. One way to get intuition as to what happens is to think about the thing in four dimensions, but not in the way that Bradley, that Bariga did, in the sense of truncating it to just two modes, but keep all of those five modes in a very complicated four-dimensional potential. And what you know about that potential is that it has a trough on the bottom because there was a classical flat direction, which is just coming from classical scalar variance. So we're asking a classical question here, so it's all over there. And then it's also known in the GTP solutions that there's no other flat directions. There's a, since they identify the general solution, you can identify in that class if there's other masses directions. And you're asking about, now we're going to turn the parameters of potential in the many dimensional space, and there's two qualitative things that you can imagine happening. The runaway proposal would correspond to one of these balls flipping down and giving you something which now you're not stopping running down. That's something which is generally doesn't happen. It can happen for a singular perturbation. It's like if you had a polynomial, this has been a quartic potential, and you turned off the quartic term, say, and so now you're dominated by a cubic term, this is what would happen. But it's a very special thing that happens when you perturb the highest thing that's sensitive to larger speeds. The generic thing that you normally have to worry about would be that you really just move minimum around a little bit. And moving it sideways isn't really a big deal. You'd be worried that you could curve it up or down. That's the thing that keeps you worried about the most. So the kind of thing that you can address with the GTP solution is that this can be, if it's true that you don't run away, then it will be perturbed, but it gets perturbed sideways. It doesn't go up or down. If it went up or down, then once you finished rolling around and you came back to the bottom again, you'd be in the scissor space or any scissor space. And that would mean that there would have to be a solution in the GTP category because the scissor space or any scissor space, and there are none. They're all flat in the solution. So the thing you can rule out is the possibility that you come back to the GTP solution and the small perturbation up or down, which is generically loose happening most. So that's the sense in which you have information directly from the GTP solution. But a better time-dependent analysis is in there. Next thing is loops. So the Weinberg's objection to self-terms like this relied on the fact that you can certainly have a flat direction and we have a flat direction. It's there because of scale invariance, exactly like Weinberg's theorem was started off with. And his objection was that now, even if you assume scale invariance is true at one level, the flat direction would be lifted by quantum directions. The way that happens in this theory is that he's exactly right. The flat direction does get lifted. It's even worse in the sense that this is a classical scale invariance. There's no the scale anomaly is not zero, it's just explicitly broken by quantum directions. And so you get a potential, it doesn't even have to be 5 or 4, it could be powers of 5. And so you can calculate what they are. Now the interesting thing is that they're there, but they're not large. And the reason they're not large is because of the supersymmetry in the bulk that's protecting this flatness. Because you're looking at the directions of a bulk field, it's the supersymmetries of the bulk that are important. And because that's such a supersymmetric theory, that the directions are so gentle. That they're there, as Weinberg says, they have to be there, and that's what dark energy is now. But it's not a problem to the existence of the mechanism of the self-turning mechanism. It is a problem to the non-supersymmetric model. So if you work out, so what's been done is, for these quantum directions, is they've been calculated for, they've been explicitly calculated, they're finding their ultraviolet sensitive parts for specific geometries like spheres and toroid. And the ultraviolet sensitive parts have been calculated for general geometries because there's a general framework for doing that for those relative directions. If you calculate it for a sphere, you typically find is that the potential is a function of the radius. What I'm doing here is I'm imagining that the dilaton has been re-expressed for the radius, so we're following one flat direction along the bottom of the potential and labeling it with radius. You typically get one over R to the fourth. This is, what I'm going to do is describe the answer for integrating on the massive fields first, and then I'll do kind of integrating massive fields, which will be both products. Massive fields give you, on dimensional grounds essentially, one over R to the fourth, with a logarithmic dependence. The logarithmic dependence comes about because on spheres, you have a delta product urgency you can get, because you can imagine that there's a counter term in six dimensions you can have, which is not zero for the sphere. And that's things like the integral t6x of you could imagine that having a cosmological constant, you could imagine having r to the big mass of four, which is m squared and r squared. You could have log m r cubed in six dimensions. Those are the dangerous kind of things. And also, Rivers are several terms of the related symmetry. So the symmetry doesn't allow you to cosmological constant, turns out. It does allow you to look on potential sometimes. You might say, but those are the same size as this, as the equation of motion for the Hilbert constant. This is really the supergravity action to start off with. So that's where normalization of Hilbert constant, which is again relevant for this adjustment. So the dangerous ones are really these ones. And you can see that you can get, for massive fields, you can get this one, but for massless fields, you typically won't. So what you typically get for massless fields is a divergence, which is logarithmic and goes like 1 over r to the 4th. And it's the existence of that divergence, which is why you have a large logarithmic yes. And that's what you find. This is the foundation, and it's very easy to do. The coefficient you can calculate robustly in this guy depends on the detail of how you parameterize the experience. On tri, this divergence is not there because the first is zero in my case, so then you just get an answer which is explicitly finite, except for the potential cosmological constant, which is actually in the case. And you get something which is functional of the shape modulus divided by R in the form. And you can do that for, that was done for, it's a general function of shape modulus by most people, and for specific choices of tori, it's been done with an orbital, so you can do it very generally for the shape modulus. Alright. So to what extent is this a problem? This is not a problem. Neither of these is a problem, because the size of the answer here is the size of 1. Remember, 1 R was the symmetry rating scale, and then the supersymmetry rating scale of all. If R is 100 microns or 10 microns or something like that, then 1 over R to the 4th is the right answer. So these are exactly what you want to see in the answer. The things that are allowed by Weinberg's theorem are what you're seeing is our energy. That's why it's not 0. The thing that's dangerous is the ultraviolet stuff. If I start integrating on physics at the weak scale, which in this picture is very short distance physics on a six-dimensional scale, because the six dimensions are on the micron scale, and we're not integrating on things down to plus the fermion size. Those things know about the short distance physics, and again, their influence on the quantum corrections is dictated by general covariance extra dimensions. It's tempting for many people, particularly particle physicists, when they do this kind of calculation, think of this as being a bunch of four-dimensional fields, whose line modes, which I have to add up, they all merge, so if I add them up, they'll merge even more. And that's actually a deceptive way of thinking, because the counterterms in six dimensions are constrained by general covariance in six dimensions, and you miss that if you think of things that whose line on it, whose line calculation, which is something that's going to be trying to control. So if you do the calculation, the kinds of things you get are what you expect to get. You get all these things, plus their partners in supersymmetry, and you get them not only in the ball, which is the ball terms, and you also get, from integrating on the bulk modes, you get brain counterterms. And that's because, if you think about them, the brains, if you think about passive energy, the stress energy, the vacuum energy, the total vacuum energy is a finite constant for, once you subtract off the cosmological constant in the imperial space. But the T mu, if you calculate it, or T00, varies as a function of distance as you get closer to the plate. And so, if you calculate the local quantities, you get divergences due to the fact that the stress energy is a function of separation, which is diverging as you approach the boundary. So that happens here too. That gives you new counterterms that you need, which are localized at the positions of the boundaries. And they're localized because if you're integrating on a particle of mass m whose wavelength is very short, the influence of these kind of divergences can't escape into the bulk very far because they're localized by the mass of the particle. So these things are there, even if you hadn't put them there from the integrating of the brains. The integrating of the brain physics gives you the same kind of stuff. This is the stuff that we've talked about before. This is the new stuff. Now, at this point, there's two things to say. One of them I said already, so I'll go over 15. So some of these things are just forbidden by supersymmetry, or they're not dangerous because of supersymmetry. So the cosmological constants in both cases are just vanished because of supersymmetry. There's no pattern like that in supersymmetric theory because the supersymmetric pattern is at the top. The curvature terms are there, but they're the classical actions, so that doesn't change the order that makes it imply. The dangerous ones are these ones. So it's the usual story. This one, if you translate it into a potential energy, looks like m squared over r squared. And this one looks like 1 over r to the 4. This is the one we like. This is the dangerous one. Said differently, this is the m units integrating into the fourth term, which you can get. And this is the thing that you generically can get also, which is bigger than the length of the core. So what we're finding in the polyvalent behavior experiences is what you expect from four dimensions anyway. Things vanish to some specific scale, but not necessarily in the quarter of the power to some specific scale. And so the issue is, in six dimensions, is physics the same as the most important dimensions? Is it, can you arrange this to be zero and get this kind of behavior rather than generic behavior? And the short answer is that is yes, you can get it. So a generic supergravity in six dimensions will have this non-zero. So don't get me wrong, it's possible to get this, just like it is in four dimensions. But there exists six-dimensional theories for which this is zero, and this is a leading term. And an example of those is if you take the field content in six dimensions, you would drop it for 10 dimensions, say, with a dimensional reducer on a torus. And that field content has additional cancellations in this term, which make them zero and give this a leading term. And that makes sense in the sense that the physics you're integrating out, if you were thinking in a 10-dimensional context, the extra dimensions in that case are at the weak scale. And the physics you're integrating out sees those extra dimensions because you're integrating out weak scale physics. And so there's room for additional cancellations to happen at the ultraviolet level because it's starting to see the fact that it's more of a supersymmetry problem than you were bargaining for at the micron scale at 6 dimensions. There's one sleight of hand I'm doing here is that I know this statement is true in the case of the ungauged supergravities where the solutions are richly flat. In the sense that a lot of these terms are zero, it's really the Riemann terms that are the ones that are dangerous, and those ones are generally show zero for that field content. The ones you'd like to show this for are the ones that are spherical solutions, because in that case, the dilaton is related to the radius by the equation of motion, and higher loops corrections, higher parts of the dilaton are also not dangerous because the dilaton is so small because the radius is so large. But that particular calculation for the sphere, again, one of my definitions, is almost not enough.
If you try to do some calculation with the decay modes, you see that you get very large contributions for these, and then you can understand what we see with the sun has better behavior than...
Yes. What happens is that, it's essentially the same thing that's been happening for the boundaries. So what happens is that it looks like you've got more options. If you took this format, you say that the logarithms would have stopped at r cubed to r squared, and you would have said this is fine. And what happens is that in four dimensional analysis, every mode, this is finite. When you do the sum of the modes, that's the convergence because it's like the modes we've seen. So let me cut to the chase here because I'm out of time. Let me just talk about the issue you raised with the topological constraints. I'll talk about the topological constraints, particularly on flat spaces, and then I'll just give you a few minutes to move to the top of the game. There's a number of solutions of this type that we looked at that are flat. What I want to argue here is that it's easy to confuse the topological constraint for fine-tuning. And remember, the issue is we want to start with a theory of weak scale and integrate it from weak scale to the cosmological constant scale and ask, given that you've got a solution to zero, do you generate a new solution? So I'm describing a continuous process. So again, topological constraints are not going to be a problem because once they're true for the original solution, then the process of integrating out will eliminate because it's a continuous process. But it's true that it's easy to see these topological constraints and think you fine-tune things. And that's because if you think about flat solutions, now I'm focusing on two dimensions that are actually flat and the only curvatures are coming from these non-linear polarities. You can get solutions like that that are in tori, obviously, but you can also get them which are topological spheres by having defect angles that add up to So in those cases, the Euler number is just pulling down to some of the defect angles, and that's the Euler number that depends on the particular solution perspective. If you did this argument I gave you with the cosmological constant, remember it was some of the tensions and then it was some classical action piece, which is always zero on general grounds, regardless of the solution lines because of the classical scaling. But if you didn't recognize that last part, and you just focus on this particular solution, what you see is that the only thing that's surviving the rest of the stuff is flat solutions. The way you get a solution is for flat, and all the other fields are constants. So that essentially there's no maximum fields, there's no constant constants, so everything else will be actually zero. And the only thing that survives in the action is this Einstein term, which is the Euler number, and so you end up with some of the tensions minus something like the Euler number. And for the poor I, it looks like you're explicitly being forced some tension to zero, and you say, oh, well, that's why the plasma test is zero, I tune them all against each other. And if it's a sphere, you're not coming into zero. You do it with positive things, but you're again just to a particular value, it looks like, and that's why you're getting zero. But now if you ask, so that makes it sound like you tune things, what would actually happen now if you change the tension in one of the solutions? The thing that would happen would be not that you get an answer cosmological constant, as we've seen this is a general argument for saying that the x is zero. What would really happen is that the solution would stay flat and fall and fall. It would adjust. And so this expression would have more terms in it. It wouldn't look like these guys are canceling anymore because they're canceling for any cancellation. But that's irrelevant really because it's something which you know that it's going to be zero on general ground because it's just a scalar variance of both things. Let me get to the conclusions, and then if anyone has questions, I've been here for a long time. So there are many things to think about in this proposal. What I like about this proposal is that I think it's gone past some of the issues. Self-tuning, I hate to call it self-tuning because every time I do, people spit on me, and, you know, metaphorically speaking, because of the five-dimensional self-tuning, which was pretty not self-tuning. And I think there are issues, so there are many proposals, most of which are killed by Wander's theorem. And this proposal, I hope I convinced you, goes farther than any of the proposals did in the sense that it's evading some of the issues that the Dharma Via problem. It's not completely clear that it's evading them all, and I couldn't actually tell you the ones that I'm most worried about, but I can at the end if you like. The various things you have to check in all of these proposals is, did you have hidden tunings, like I just talked about the topological ones? Some of these proposals were actually started prematurely because the tunings that were identified were actually topological adjustments, so the topological conditions, and they would actually be stable under the process of integrating out of physics from these fields into the topological process. So some of them are actually more robust than I thought, but typically, the thing that kills most of them is the absence of supersymmetry because that's crucial for the evasion of Weinberg's theorem and keeping the small size of the scales small. It's also true that six dimensions is special because that's for the numerology of this. The supersymmetry rating scale is what we use for Carnegie column, it's also the topological process. So you're left with a very unique picture. You need to worry about loops, you need to worry about responses, you need to worry about how the time evolution goes and why you think this is more, find more general classes of solutions. But it's all very, very doable with technology we have now because the six-dimensional series is so simple. Much of it is progress. But what's exciting about it is that it actually has many implications. If this is right, it will be right in your face because it's going to not only be dark energy, but dark energy is going to have a potential and it's going to be powers of one of our own, which is an exponential potential. So it has a very specific kind of phenomenology for dark energy. It predicts things for how the evolution of the equation state would behave. It's going to have a long-range force that's competing with gravity. And that's a potentially dangerous chronological issue because you have a lot of constraints on it along this because it's very sensitive to light scale field. It's a deviation from gravity on small scales because you're getting six dimensions almost immediately. And you can't change the radius of x dimensions without ruining the agreement with the cosmological process. So your force, if they don't see the force deviation in the inverse parallel by 1 micron, this is wrong. 1 micron is what you're led to because the numbers for the cosmological constant, once you put in the factors of 2 pi, lead you to a radius the way I started of 10 microns, and that's all you can include fine masses of 2 pi and it's 1 micron. So what's exciting is that we're talking about 2 pi now, the cosmological constant, not the factors of all, you know, log of 10 to 50. It also means, like all these large exponential models, that there's a lot of, you can produce every mode is coupled gravitationally, but there's so many modes that when you sum them up, you're essentially doing gravitational physics with six dimensions if you're at the weak scale, as we are in colliders. And that means that you're effectively seeing gravity as a weak interaction process there. It's more than people look at this for gravitons, and gravitons have observable signals, or can have observable signals at colliders. And this will have even more because there's more channels in the bulk that people have to paint for, because there's the graviton and all the superparticles. And depending on the supergravity model, that could be a lot of superparticles. Normal cancellation of the Carnot models typically, well, if you have one gauge model, you have to have 244 plus one matter model. So there's lots of fields in the bulk, depending on what supergravity is. And there's so many of them that this kind of physics will point you towards models which are probably not Carnot, because it's probably true that you can't afford to have more than a few supermodels involved without any problems. But there's observable signals, in particle physics and in tests of gravity of long-range processes, and probably elsewhere, which are hard not to observe. One last thought I'll leave you with is that this is a counterexample of a signal that if you break supersymmetry to weak scale, then you have to be plugging into the MSSM, the minimal supersymmetry standard model. Because this is a realization wherein supersymmetry breaks to weak scale, and yet the electron has no spin partners that you're going to see colliders necessarily, depending on the details of exactly where the grain scale is in the structure. So it's enormously predictive. It's gone farther, I think, than many proposals have for the rest of the natural systems, and that's certainly a worthwhile goal for the time cap. So thank you.
I'm wondering, when we did see that there were, you said these conditions were interesting, there were custom models.
The things that were in their models? Yeah, actually, I didn't have any good stuff. I got it up here in my second campus. So the, so the ones that are the most worrisome are, there's two that I'm worried about. One is, I said it all works at the radius of frame. One question is, why is the radius as large as it is? That's about analytics. That doesn't worry me quite so much, because for the spherical solutions I showed you, the potential was, I feel like it's a preamble of what they do. The potential was something like a constant over R to the fourth, with log R. And this is intense, which is basically falling like this, and there's a little bit of shape here where the logarithm is going to go from one. And so one thing people typically, your intuition is that you want to stabilize the radii at 10 microns. And actually, that's not quite. In this picture, dark energy, you're not stabilizing the moti. All you need to do is rolling through here right around now. And then what happens is that if you look at the evolution, this actually is a cosmological model that we explored earlier before this proposal. And it's a special class of Albrecht scores potential. And essentially, at the expense of saying, if you start off with a radius at the before degree distance, which is roughly 10 microns, then what will happen is that even if you spend lots of energy, it's rolling like crazy. Then there's so much Hubble damping that it's actually sits at one spot. And it very naturally emerges here now. And so then this feature, what's going on is that this there's a loop factor here, which is of the order of 1 over 4 pi cubed, or the n over 4 pi cubed, where n is the number of units. So that's easy to make that 1 over 70. So this shape happens in a log r, is like 7. And that, but this is a Planck thing, so that's 10 microns. So it's easy to have this not be exactly 10 microns, but it's also not difficult to make this 10 microns. So there's an issue with the technology for the radius can work. But what we're seeing is that it's not sufficient to have the radius right. You have to also have all the work components also be small, because all the numerology I gave you assume that the geometry does not work. And if you start dwarfing the geometry, what will happen is, I think the statement I gave you is correct, that you can make models where the answer at the quantum level for the dark energy is the Kluge-Klein mass of the fourth. But the numerical state of the Kluge-Klein mass has to be 1 over 10 microns. It assumes that there's no warping. And if you have warping, then given the strength of gravitational interactions, the radius could be led to, if it worked, the such that Kluge-Klein mass would be larger and not be more than this. So that's my biggest worry right now. And the second worry is that, where's the related worries are, does the cosmology of forming distances make sense? Because in all these large exponential models, the problem is you generically have problems if you're in equilibrium, very much the forming distances. Because there's so many Kluge-Klein models that actually manage to be populated. And if you do, then they're stable when they start to close the universe. So it's very difficult to get the distances right. And in particular, there's lots of reasons why you'd like to have cosmology at the weak scale in this kind of model, because you have to ask where's dark matter? Don't have a slight particle. So the whole issue of cosmology is not here that it can be made work yet. It's not here that it can't make it work, because the way people thought about it so far is, I think, in the world of the torus, the gas is final. Whereas this dynamic is much more complicated. The radius, the energy cost of making the whole shape of the actual dimensions change is not actually very large in the universe. So what will really happen is that the classical solution will be evolving, and you'll have quantum computations around that. And so the conclusions people have drawn are based on the two superficial calculations to tell. But it may yet be that there's a real problem in the cosmology of these things. But the warping is the most dangerous one. Like I said, I'm here all the time. If you have any questions, I'll be around for the rest of your time.
Yeah, that's sure.
That would come out.
Can't find it.
All those ways, since I don't really jump through all of it.
That's right.